Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 61, Transformers Transformed. Hello, this is Denise Howell, and we're here for Episode 61 of This Week in Law, recording live Friday, May 21st, 2010. And with us here today are Fred Von Lohmann from EFF. Welcome, Fred.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Thanks so much for taking the time. Also with us are Jeff Richardson, the iPhone JD. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Denise. It's an honor to be here.
Great to have you. And returning for a triumphant revisit to TWiL, having taken a break last week, Evan Brown. Hi, Evan. How are you?
Hey, doing great. And I'd like to think that everything I do is triumphant, but we'll work on that. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Great to have you back. Lots to discuss this week. So let's start out by tying up a loose end from last week where we discussed the class action that has been filed against Sony concerning the PS3 and the removal of a feature that had been part of the operating system for that device. I think that I got a whole bunch of email about this. Folks were wanting to clarify that what's at stake here is not simply a capability of the PS3 to run other operating systems that was removed by Sony, but actually a menu level feature that was part of the software versions 3.21 and prior, I believe, and also part of Sony's marketing and advertising for the device. It enabled you to run other software, other OSs like Linux. And that is what was removed. And I guess users in Europe were actually able to get refunds from Amazon on this point, even though their devices were far out of warranty. But here in the U.S., we've got a class action lawsuit pending over the removal of that menu level feature. So thanks so much for the folks who wrote in to clarify that we're not just talking about something the device was capable of doing that, you know, creative users decided they were going to exploit, but something that was there and intended from the get-go. So that's why there's a dispute about this. Fred, I'm not sure I first learned of this from the EFF site. Are you guys directly involved with these proceedings or just following them?
We're just following them at this point. Obviously, we heard about it when the media began reporting it, and actually PS3 forums, user forums, were actually lit up about this, and we started hearing from people directly about it. So, but we're not right now directly involved in the lawsuit.
Okay. Thanks for that. Also, from last week, a follow-up to something we discussed there. Among the lawsuits being brought or to be brought by, what is this group's name? The Copyright Group, I believe they're calling themselves, out of D.C., is one that is anticipated against BitTorrent users who downloaded the Hurt Locker. And we had Shani Jardin on the show last week where we discussed that. She subsequently posted to Boing Boing just about the fact that these lawsuits were in the pipeline. And she heard from one of their readers who was a concerned citizen who wrote to Nicolas Chartier, the president of, let's see, it's Voltage Pictures, the folks who made the Hurt Locker. And he wrote a fairly polite email to the guy, just registering his disapproval of the strategy of going after users and informing Mr. Chartier that he would be boycotting the film and not purchasing it or viewing it in protest of this strategy. Mr. Chartier came back with quite a response where he, it was sort of reminiscent, although much more wordy, of some of the things we've seen out of Steve Jobs lately, where, you know, just not pulling any punches. And he tells Nicholas to please feel free to leave his house open every time he goes out, and please tell his family to do so. Invite people in the streets to come in and take things from you, not to make money, but just to use it for themselves and help themselves. He goes on to get pretty insulting, calls him a moron, hopes his family winds up in jail one day for stealing so that they can be taught the difference, and calls him stupid, and please do not download, rent, or pay for any of his movies, Mr. Chartier says, because he likes smart and, more importantly, honest people to watch his films. So bring that up just as a ongoing point in this discussion. Evan, did you have a chance?
No, you say it sounds like Steve Jobs. It sounds almost like a fake Steve Jobs, Dan Lyon. It's a little so over the top. It almost sounds like it's a parody of itself.
Exactly. It totally does. Evan, did you have a chance to check this out?
I did, and this guy really knows how to make fans, doesn't he? Probably the most important thing about this email is, it's important to note here on the excerpt that's on Boing Boing, is that it was sent at 2:30 in the morning, 2:30 Pacific time, so that's late anywhere. So, I'm surprised it doesn't drop some F-bombs, or even it's not even more colorful than what it is, because who knows what Mr. Chartier was doing up checking his email, engaging in substantive dialogue at 2:30 in the morning like this. So it's just a wonderful little example about how passionate this guy is about his stuff and how locked up he feels his rights are. And, more power to him, because, I haven't seen the movie. I heard it's good, but now I just know that I won't either, because I'm not nearly honest enough, I guess, or smart enough for that matter.
Fred, this is one where you guys are involved, is it not?
Well, we are involved in a way. We are already hearing from dozens of people who have discovered that their identity is being sought by this U.S. copyright group, as they call themselves. And so we're trying to help folks who are being targeted in these lawsuits, and trying to find lawyers who are willing to help them out, and figure out whether or not there's anything that can be done about the campaign overall. Just so your viewers understand, the U.S. Copyright Group is not an industry association. It's not like the Motion Picture Association or the Recording Industry Association. It appears to be kind of a group of freelance lawyers who have decided that this is going to be an interesting way to make quite a bit of money. And they've basically said to independent filmmakers like the producer of Hurt Locker and Uwe Boll, who, maker of movies like Far Cry, for those who've heard of that, they've said to these independent producers, hey, sign up to be our clients, and in exchange, we will go after thousands, tens of thousands. In the case of the Hurt Locker, they're promising 100,000 targets in order to squeeze settlements out of most of them, and then essentially split the money. So presumably the lawyers will keep the money. I don't know how much, but some of the reports suggest a majority of the money will go to the lawyers, and a minority will go to the copyright owners who've been signed up as plaintiffs here. So this is sort of a classic copyright troll strategy. This isn't about trying to stop piracy. It's about making money for lawyers.
It's not a perfect analogy, but it does strike me as the copyright equivalent of patent trolling.
It sure does look a lot like that, and we'll see. Interestingly, we saw this week at least one of the ISPs involved has stood up for their customer as well, and also, for that matter, stood up for themselves and said, hey, we're not going to hand over hundreds or thousands of names. At least we're not going to do it on the U.S. Copyright Group's timetable, and we're not going to do it without being paid. So I think if this group is going to be hitting ISPs with subpoenas for thousands or tens of thousands of subscriber names and addresses, I wouldn't be surprised to see some of the ISPs put up a bit of a fight about that. I think in the papers, Time Warner Cable, which is the ISP who's putting up a fight so far, they pointed out that it costs them internal costs $45 per IP number that they're forced to look up in terms of both technical costs and staffing and the like. Now, that may not seem like a lot, but if you're talking about 100,000 IP numbers, well, then maybe it does seem like a lot.
Good for them. I'm glad they're Time Warner's putting up a fight. I mean, as you say, clearly they're standing up for themselves and their own interests and not being bogged down in all of this administrivia. But the thing that irritates me the most about what the U.S. Copyright Group is doing here is not so much what we could characterize as the trollish nature of their endeavor. I think we can agree that that's what it is. I mean, maybe or maybe not the there's, you know, a strong claim of copyright, you know, copyright ownership. I don't think anybody's going to say that the ownership of the copyright is tenuous. But what's even more irksome to me is just this, the way that they're trying to leverage this massive economy of scale, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of lawsuits. I mean, that's just that's just a really silly way of going about it. So it's good that Time Warner is recognizing the complexity of that and recognizing the expense and cost to them, not only to what, as I understand it, they're not only objecting to just having to respond to all these subpoenas, but aren't they making some kind of argument that there should be an individual lawsuit filed against each individual defendant? And so therefore they should have to pay, like, you know, the $200-$300 filing fee for each defendant. That's somehow playing into this, isn't it? By somebody, maybe Time Warner?
Yeah, that's right. Time Warner made the point in their filings that this is what we lawyers call improper joinder, that adding each of these complaints has 2,000 or more defendants in it. And so, you know, the complaint is, you know, Uwe Boll versus Does 1 through 2,094. And I think the courts are going to smell a rat here because they're going to say, hey, wait a minute, you're trying to keep your costs down and not pay the courts the filing fees that normally are, you know, paid when lawsuits get filed. Another interesting part about this lawsuit is whether or not jurisdiction is proper, because if you do a reverse DNS lookup on the IP addresses that are included in these complaints, you'll see that the vast majority of them are far away from Washington, D.C., which is where these suits are being brought. So I think there's a jurisdiction problem here. I think the recording industry, for example, ultimately solved this problem by filing lawsuits locally where the individual defendants were found. And as I said, anybody who understands anything about the internet knows that it's not hard to do a reverse DNS lookup on an IP number. And those records that come back usually tell you something about where the individual is located if the IP number belongs to an ISP. So, you know, you'll see something that says Houston.comcast.net or something that lets you know that, hey, this person probably lives in Houston, not in Washington, D.C. So there are some problems with these complaints. I just also want to add Time Warner Cable is not related to Time Warner Inc., the big content company. They used to be, but they were spun out a while ago. So any of your viewers who are confused about why a content company like Time Warner is suddenly fighting, these are two totally separate companies. And I think that tells us something important as well.
Yep.
Right. And it's sort of...
One other point I just want to make. Okay, just one other point I wanted to make here. When you file lawsuits, this is taking up a point Evan just made. When you file lawsuits by the thousands or target individuals by the thousands, what we've seen is it is 100% guaranteed that you are going to end up targeting innocent people, right? We saw this when DirecTV targeted 125,000 people for legal threats based on simply ordering cards for satellite receivers that they believed could be used for satellite piracy. We saw it again in the recording industry's campaign where they targeted 35,000 people for legal action. There were, you know, grandmothers who said, hey, I don't even have a computer that can do this, or I don't listen to that kind of music. So for us, the problem is when you start doing lawsuits by the thousands, where the point is to squeeze settlements out of people, not to ever go to court, not to ever hear the evidence. You create a world where innocent people get caught up, and it costs more for an innocent person to defend themselves than to settle the case. So what you end up having here is basically dolphins who are being caught in the net who really don't have any way out.
Jeff, you had a comment?
I mean, I was only going to point out, I realize that it's popular to take the position that Fred is advocating, and a big part of me does. You know, many of us have had some youthful indiscretion on downloading things. Perhaps we should not have done so. But, you know, when you think about these lawsuits, I can't help but feel a little bit for the content creators because, you know, there's no question that their content is being used in ways that they did not want to be used. And although they must know that these lawsuits are an imperfect solution, it surely has a deterrent effect. you know, people are going to be reading these articles in the newspaper and then thinking twice before they download something illegally. You know, many of us on this call are content creators. I have my own little bitty blog. You know, I try to post once a day on my blog and sometimes once every business day. And sometimes over the weekends, I will write a post that I will put on later in the week. And, you know, if somebody accessed my server and said, you know, this is such a great post, Jeff, I'm going to make it available to the public before you are ready to do so, which is what happens with the Hurt Locker movie, that would seem a little unfair to me. And if these types of lawsuits had some effect of deterring people and reminding them to do the right thing, you know, I just think it's not an easy issue. I realize that there's another side of it and innocent people are being caught too, but you know, it's a problem for content creators and you know, there's two sides to the story here.
Well, I guess the alternative is to go after the ISPs for letting this sort of activity happen. The third party liability strategy, if you're not going to go after the actual infringers. But that's, of course, fraught with its own set of issues.
And that doesn't have the deterrent value that going after individual people do. So, I mean, if your goal is to make the general public remember that, you know, your content has value and shouldn't be taken in ways that you don't want. And we could talk about the practical issues that perhaps the movies get more publicity when this happens, and maybe it's actually good for them. But then that opens up the can of worms is who gets to decide what's good for the content creator? Does the content creator get to decide for himself, or does the public get to decide for them?
What do you think, Fred? You've been involved in a lot of these peer-to-peer lawsuits. Do you think that it actually dissuades people from their illegal actions?
Well, let me just step in here and point out that I have to disagree with the idea that the only choice is between suing tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, potentially millions of Americans, or suing ISPs, right? There's a simple alternative, which frankly is the alternative that has worked against piracy since the dawn of copyright, which is get out in the marketplace and offer consumers what they're after at a price that they find palatable in a format that they find convenient, right? I mean, that is always the only long-term solution to this problem. And, you know, the truth of the matter is if people made the movies available more easily, I think you would see a lot of this dry up.
You left out at a time that is actually commonsensical as far as the marketplace demands. This whole windowing strategy seems to be backfiring on Hollywood quite a bit.
Right. I mean, I think we are, you know, Hollywood is still using a business model that made a lot of sense in 1990. In a time when you could say, okay, first we're going to do theaters, then we're going to, you know, do video on demand, we're going to do cable, we're going to do DVD, and it's all going to be done in order, and we're going to roll it out in the world in a staggered fashion so the people in England can't see it at the same time as the people in the US. And, you know, that model doesn't work in an internet era. Every time you create frustrated demand, you create an incentive for people to seek out the so-called dark net alternative. Find it out there somewhere else. And the bottom line here is, you know, I'd love a world where you could say to a content owner, don't worry about these things. But short of basically stopping the internet, I think the only long-term solution that's a win here is one where you get out there and you give the customer what they want at a time when they want it. And frankly, people are willing to pay, right? You've seen, obviously, you can get everything on iTunes for free somewhere else. And yet people go to iTunes. Obviously, you have sites like Hulu that are experimenting mm-hmm. with new models around advertising. So,
right, and people seem to be lining up to pay for the premium version of Hulu when it's available.
Not to mention, of course, let's not forget that they are having the biggest box office years in history. So these are not companies like the record industry, which can claim to be hurting. The movie studios are doing fantastically well 10 years after peer-to-peer hit the scene. So let's not cry crocodile tears for movie makers just yet. In fact, I choose instead to be inspired by creators like Nina Paley, who made that great Sita Sings the Blues animated feature on her own dime, working, and she's basically turned this availability into a virtue by making her film available in lots of different formats online, which has actually been a key to her, you know, success and getting more attention and getting more DVD releases. And now she's available on Netflix. And so I think it's not just about how do we deter and stop people from doing what they're going to do anyway.
Well, Fred, I just think that decision should belong to the content creators. I agree that my desire to illegally download 30 Rock is non-existent because I know that I can go on Hulu and watch an episode that I missed. But it seems like the content creator of 30 Rock or the content creator of a little blog post or whoever it is should be the ones to decide whether they're going to be on the cutting edge of, you know, putting things out there and trying to make money in the long run and, you know, make no money on the records, but make it all on t-shirts or whatever the model is. That should be their decision to make. And, you know, if a content producer decides I'm not ready for this brave new world and I want to go the traditional means, even if it means that I make less money, they should be able to do so. And if, you know, the control should perhaps not be in the hands of the people that want to violate copyrights and download, but instead be in the hands of the content creators. I agree with you on a practical matter, though. I mean, I think any good content creator should, you know, do what you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm afraid that may sound good in an ideal world, but I'm afraid that's not the world we live in. And that's frankly not the way copyright has traditionally worked either, right? Sure, it would be great if every songwriter could control what radio station played their song and when they played it and all of that. But that's not the system we have, right? Copyright law has lots of portions built into it that are intended to accommodate technological reality. And as I said, after 10 years of lawsuits and 10 years of hand-wringing, I still haven't heard anybody come up with a quote-unquote solution for people being able to copy on the internet that isn't much worse than the disease. So while I understand the attraction of, oh, the copyright owners should have dominion over these questions, you know, you also can't turn back the tide of technology. You know, we've lived with VCRs and photocopiers and audio cassette recorders for a long time. And, you know, now we're going to live with the internet and we need to find a way that gets creators paid, right? The key to copyright is get the creator compensated. The key to copyright has never been, first and foremost, to give the copyright owner total control over their creative work.
You know, you guys are kind of representing here a real perennial tension that's always gone on in this. And you know, you've expressed two disparate views that really have historically underlied what copyright's all about. And that is, you know, what does it mean to promote the progress? You know, the quoting from the language in the Constitution that gives the power to Congress to enact laws that regulate copyright. And I think both of you guys are making some very valid points in this. And it's just really kind of a modern day incarnation of that same tension that's been going on since the dawn of creativity and the regulation of creativity. What is the role of a governing system to make sure that the creative impulses are sufficiently incented to do these things and that the desire to enjoy those things doesn't overpower which would manifest itself in some kind of piracy. That desire to share on the creative efforts of others doesn't run rampant, but that there's some sort of equilibrium, some sort of balance. And, you know, given the modern technological context, that problem is quite complex and multifactorial, shall we say.
Yeah, and when it comes right down to it, I mean, we can agree or disagree with the strategy of bringing lawsuits, but it is permitted. There's nothing, in the copyright law that prevents these folks from trolling in this way and from
as long as they follow the rules. That's all we're asking is you got to follow the rules. And we talked about the jurisdiction problem and the joinder mm-hmm. problem. But I agree with you, as long as they're following the rules.
Right. And one instance where it seems questionable whether the rules have been followed is, say you're sitting around in your office having a boring afternoon, and below you, all of a sudden in the street, you see cars flying through the air and a film crew at work, and you whip out your camera and you start taping, and you realize partway through, hey, these guys are filming Transformers 3. How cool. One of my favorite movies. And you post the stuff up to YouTube. And what do you think happens as a result of that? Well, of course, the DMCA happens when it is perhaps not read in the right way here by Paramount Pictures, who went ahead and told YouTube to take that down. What do you think happened here? I mean, I really am struggling to come up with a cognizable basis for Paramount to go ahead and do the DMCA dance. for something that was not the actual film, but taking place in a public place for anyone, you know, in the offices above to view. Is there any kind of justification for claiming that that bit of footage is copyrighted by anybody other than the person who took it? What do you think, Evan?
This is a fun one because, as you said, what's going on here is you're filming the filming happening. So it's it's one layer of abstraction above the actual movie. So you're not copying the film. You're actually making your own version of it in a certain sense. So I see two real problems here, two issues that we should talk about from a copyright standpoint when examining this, you know, as if it were a law exam, hypothetical or something like that. The first problem is that of fixation. I mean, what is it that's being copied here when you are making the copy of, or when you're filming the movie taking place? You know, you're not making a copy of anything that's been reduced to a tangible medium of expression, which is, you know, a requirement for copyrightable subject matter. You're just going ahead and making that tangible medium of expression yourself in the first instance. So I guess there's an argument that there could be, by filming, an infringement of the underlying screenplay or something like that. But, you know, that gets pretty wonky in copyright terms. The other big issue...
Evan, I'm filming you as you talk. Is that okay? I'm going to sell this on the internet afterwards. But keep talking. I'm filming
that's
you.
Fine. That's fine. Just talk to Leo, because I think we're already bound under some kind of Creative Commons license. So go forth and prosper. The other interesting issue on this is fair use, of course. Let's just assume that there is copyrightable subject matter that's being copied. And, you know, there is a prima facie case of infringement going on here when you have your camera looking out the window. Okay. This reminds me of the lens case that, you know, of course, EFF was been involved with. That's the fair use case where the court held that, you know, you got to think about fair use when you're going to send a DMCA takedown notice to a provider. This really does seem like, you know, assuming that there is infringement going on here, that there's copyrightable subject matter being illegally copied in the first instance, this seems like a great case for that kind of analysis. You know, you got to think of the transformative nature. And isn't it funny? We're talking about Transformers. I just now realized that the transformative nature of what it is you're creating when you're doing this. So I love this. I love this situation. It's a fascinating thing to think about from this copyright perspective.
Well, before we go to one of the other panelists here, I just want to chime in that Christopher Fulmer on our Facebook page for Twill, which you can get to at denise.howell.net/FB, had a similar comment. He, playing devil's advocate, suggested that could the car being flung into the air be considered a choreographed or dramatic work? Mm. Mm-hmm. If you were at a play and as part of the play, a car was flung across the stage, you wouldn't be able to film it. There's probably some fixation that says, put this car on this piece of equipment and fling it up in the air at n such and such original velocity, and you've got something that might be fixed and protectable. Fred, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I frankly think that's totally ridiculous. I don't see a copyright interest here at all. I see a copyright in the person who made the video hanging out their window there. That was the person who fixed the work. Right. Sure, if the script says take a car, throw it through the air, fine. That to me sounds like an idea. Right. That's not there's nothing terribly unique and expressive about take a car and fling it through the air. The expressive activity there is when it's captured on film. And that obviously wasn't what was copied here. So I think there's no copyright interest here. I'm quite surprised to see that it was Paramount. For anybody who doesn't know this, Paramount Pictures is owned by Viacom. Which, of course, ought to know better because they're in the middle of a multi-billion dollar lawsuit with YouTube. And one of the things YouTube has pointed out is that Viacom has a bad record in terms of claiming that something is copyright infringement, and then it turns out it's not. So I think we can comfortably add this to that list. I'm happy that to have heard that the person who posted it has sent a counter notice. And so after 2 weeks have elapsed, if Paramount doesn't have the nerve to sue, then that video will be restored. On Evan's point about the lawsuit, the ability to sue Paramount for doing this, that's certainly something I would agree. I think there's a lot that's similar between this and the lens case that Evan mentioned. But, you know, quite frankly, I think you have to remember getting into a lawsuit with Paramount is not a simple matter. And that's one of the problems is what's the punishment? Why should Paramount not behave this way? Because after all, for every one of these stories that makes it into the news and gets talked about on Twill, we all know that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of takedowns that nobody ever hears about, no one complains about, where the individuals who are harmed aren't able to get the word to mainstream media. So remember, every time you see a bogus takedown, that you're seeing the tip of a much larger iceberg.
Jeff, any thoughts on this?
No, I mean, the whole thing seems a little silly to me. If you're doing something out in public and someone films you, you know, that's going to happen.
Right.
Or if you're sitting in your office talking on Twill, somebody's going to hold up their iPhone.
Exactly. Let's see. It was Kevin Poulsen who had a good post at Threat Level about this. And he had a fun comment that... Let's see. It's not likely anyone mistook the cell phone footage as actual movie clips, so it seems possible that someone at Paramount saw Transformers in the YouTube title and fired off the notice without watching the video. So a cautionary tale for anyone who is going to go down the DMC road, because obviously there are penalties if you do it the wrong way. That would be sad, since issuing bogus DMCA notices, Kevin writes, can sometimes be civilly actionable, as we discussed. Plus, it would mean they missed some excellent car flinging. So we appreciate the fact to get a clue into Transformers. And by the way, I mean, what great publicity for the film to see some of what's going on as it's happening. But as long as we're on the Hollywood beat here, let's stick to it and talk about the Congressional Anti-Piracy Caucus, which has issued its first annual list of havens for international copyright theft and has indicted various nationalities for being the worst offenders here. Fred, do you think that this is... anything that is remarkable, or any kind of gauntlet thrown? Is this just more going on between Hollywood and DC?
Well, if I'm thinking of the same story that you're mentioning here, it wasn't just singling out countries. It was actually mm-hmm. singling out specific companies in specific countries. Mm-hmm. And the list that I saw specifically called out RapidShare, which I thought was really interesting right now, because RapidShare actually has recently won two lawsuits, one in Germany and one here in the United States. Well, I should be a little clearer. In Germany, they had there was a lower court ruling that had found that RapidShare was liable for copyright infringement, or at least potentially liable for copyright infringement, based on hosting content on behalf of users where that content wasn't, you know, supposed to be uploaded by those users. And there was recently an appeal, and just a couple of weeks ago, RapidShare won that appeal in Germany. The appeals court threw out that lower court ruling and said, in fact, hey, RapidShare is just a hosting provider, and under European law, they can't be held responsible as long as they comply with notice and takedown, which they do. And then, as I said, just a few days ago in the United States, in San Diego, there was a ruling where Perfect 10, the rather infamous erotic photography site, brought a preliminary injunction to try to basically shut down RapidShare's ability to host images that were uploaded by users from Perfect 10's copyrighted photograph catalog. And the court in San Diego basically said the same thing, said RapidShare is just a hosting provider. That's not enough to make them liable under U.S. law for those infringements, unless they were first told specifically and failed to take steps to remove that content. And so you have a situation here where this group is saying RapidShare is a pirate haven at the same moment when at least two courts in two different countries have said they are not a pirate haven. So I think that makes us all take this with a grain of salt. This is part of the rhetorical propaganda battle between Hollywood and, you know, these countries and these companies. I wouldn't take it as gospel that these companies are, in fact, the pirates that Hollywood claims they are.
So in the RapidShare decision, an injunction was not issued, correct?
That's right. The court denied the request for an injunction, finding that Perfect 10 was not likely to succeed on its copyright claims against RapidShare.
Right. And there's a pretty lengthy discussion in the order that you sent us prior to the show. If there's a place that that order lives online, I'll stick it in the show notes if anybody has access to that.
Yeah, that should be that. There's been some coverage, so it's posted a couple of places online. Should be pretty easy to find. And just for the copyright nerds in the audience, one of the interesting things about that ruling is it was not based on the DMCA safe harbors, which is the U.S. law that sites like YouTube and Vio and others have traditionally relied on. RapidShare, because it's a German company, did not register a copyright agent in the United States. And so they didn't qualify for the safe harbors, but the court nevertheless found that hosting by itself is not an infringing activity, even without the safe harbors. So that's sort of an important piece of legal news for a lot of online services.
Yeah, and that's right. What I noticed about this, because that's one of those things where I think we kind of knew that all along, right? That the DMCA is independent, really, of the secondary liability analysis, but there was no clear decision on that because obviously, defendants, when they can, are always going to assert the DMCA safe harbors as an affirmative defense like that, or however, bringing it up, whether it be an affirmative defense or earlier in the matter. So that's the thing that struck me most about this was how, this is kind of a nice and pure secondary liability analysis in this case.
And then another ruling came out, Fred, that you circulated before the show against Live Universe, Inc., but here, once again, they had not registered a contact person for DMCA purposes. And here, the injunction was actually granted. What was the distinction?
Yeah, that's a short little case where a bunch of music publishers were going after websites that hosted lyrics. So this is one of these lyrics finder types of sites online where all of the lyrics are provided by the users. So the argument, at least certainly the argument I would have imagined they would have made, was, hey, we're just hosting material on behalf of users the same way web hosting providers and YouTube and everybody else does, and we should be covered by the DMCA. And they basically got beaten up pretty bad by the court, and the court started with the fact that they failed to register a copyright agent. And this is one of these things that I continue to be amazed that companies fail on this sort of formality. If you want the benefit of the DMCA safe harbors, those are the legal protections that say as long as you abide by notice and takedown and a number of other requirements, you will not be held responsible for what your users are up to. In order to qualify for any of that stuff, or at least for the ones about hosting and linking, you have to register a copyright agent with the U.S. Copyright Office. That requires sending a one-page form along with a check. I think it's a little more. It's maybe, I think, $125 now, something like that. You can get all that information on the copyright.gov website for the U.S. Copyright Office. But companies who forget to do that, who don't take that step, this court ruling says you don't get the safe harbors because that's an absolute, required prerequisite. I'm not sure I agree with that ruling, but this is, again, a ruling that tells companies you better make sure you sent that form and that check in.
Fred, what do you think, obviously, if you're a big company with a legal compliance department looking after these things, you should know better than to skip that important step. But at the other end of the spectrum, I think there's a huge possibility for third parties to slip through the cracks, people who aren't necessarily doing the infringing themselves, but might from time to time have third-party content on their sites that they're hosting. Jeff the small blogger or twit.tv, the network, brings in third-party content all the time, but may not have had the resources or foresight to register under the DMCA. Do you see this as a problem in search of a solution?
Yeah, I see this as a big problem because, as you say, there are a lot of people who host content for other people in one way or another, whether it's blog comments or images or file lockering services more generally. There's a lot of stuff in the cloud, to use kind of the current lingo. And I think a lot of folks may not realize that they have this obligation if they want the DMCA safe harbor. At least according to this court, they have an obligation to send in that form, send in that check. So I hope the message here is do it. Even if you don't think you need it, do it anyway, because it's not much money and why not? Now, there are other requirements that also have to be met. So don't get me wrong, that this by itself isn't enough. But I do think it's unfortunate, and I think it could be really unfair, because the point here is you need to have make it easy for people to know who to tell about a copyright infringement so the content gets taken down. So it seems to me kind of unfair and not terribly sensible to require every online service to have this form on file so long as they were good about taking stuff down. Now, as we pointed out earlier, maybe the rule is you win anyway, because as that rapid share ruling points out, if you've been good about taking stuff down, maybe you don't even need the DMCA safe harbors. But I agree with you that requiring this form may really be a trap for the unwary, sort of a trap for mm-hmm. the smaller entrepreneur, a trap for the company that doesn't have a full-time lawyer. And that doesn't seem like a terribly sensible outcome, as long as there has been good copyright compliance, good takedown, otherwise good behavior.
All right. Well, one company that, as long as we're on the topic of P2P and related liability, one company that was not acknowledged for its good behavior recently was LimeWire, who went the way of Grokster in being found that they were secondarily, contributorily liable for the nefarious activities of their users. We talked about this a bit on the last show. No real surprise, I guess, that LimeWire went this way, although I have not delved into the record, Fred, the way that you have in this case. But it seems to me that following Grokster, companies of this ilk are on notice that they had better be squeaky clean, or they're going to go that way in the liability department. Was there something that that could have rescued LimeWire from this kind of result?
Well, it's very hard to know. There's obviously a lot in the ruling that the court found suggested inducement, which was, again, the same basis that was discussed by the Supreme Court in the Grokster case back in 2005. And to my mind, the two troubling things about the ruling are, number one, the court in, you know, saying, oh, look at all this evidence of bad intent on the part of LimeWire. The court said that you don't even have to communicate that bad intent to your users, that basically having bad thoughts in your heart was somehow enough to make you liable for inducement if you were also distributing a piece of technology. And I think, you know, that's a very dangerous way to look at it. And I think flatly wrong and not consistent with the Supreme Court's Grokster ruling. If that were right, then potentially Apple Computer could be liable for distributing iPods just if the lead engineer or Steve Jobs had some, you know, bad intent in his heart and some emails to back that up, you know, and that's, I think, very chilling for innovators. And the other piece of the ruling that worries me is in the vicarious liability part of the ruling, where the court did not find that LimeWire was vicariously liable, but also ruled that that it could go to trial, that there was still an open issue there. The court seems to imply that your failure to put filters into a piece of peer-to-peer software, your failure to design software to enable you to control infringement, that those choices themselves indicate that you had control over what your users were up to. This is what I call the you could have designed it differently test. And again, if that's the law, then that's incredibly chilling for a lot of innovators who are going to have to ask themselves, hey, could I have done more? Could I have designed something differently? Should I have omitted this new feature? And that's exactly the kind of second guessing that I don't think we want our engineers to be engaging in, because after all, there would be no VCR, there would be no TiVo, there would be no iPod if the engineers had to spend all their time worrying about copyright owners instead of worrying about customers.
Well, Fred, I'm glad you mentioned the VCR there at the end of what you were talking about, because what I was going to say in response to what you were, the concerns you were expressing on this, you could have designed it better test, you know, with Grokster and with all the subsequent litigation since, you know, dealing with secondary copyright liability. I mean, they've never done away with the doctrine that's in the Sony case, right? About if something is capable, what is it if it's capable of a substantial non-infringing use? Doesn't that notion there, you know, pretty much, shouldn't that alleviate any concern that we would have under this, as you very, you know, creatively and nicely said it, you know, they could have designed it differently test?
Well, the problem is that the entertainment industry has been pushing hard for what I consider to be a legal end run around the Sony doctrine that you describe. So in Sony, the Supreme Court said, yes, the VCR can be used for lots of things, including non-infringing uses. And that was enough for the court in Sony. But the problem today is courts are saying that, for example, in the inducement context, the substantial non-infringing use defense will not protect you. And also the recent LimeWire ruling said for vicarious liability, which attaches once you have the ability to control infringement and you obtain a direct financial benefit from it, the court in LimeWire found that the Sony defense is no defense to a vicarious liability claim. So I think what you're seeing here is, sure, Sony is still alive. The substantial non-infringing use defense is still there, but it's only there for one of...
I think that so maybe we got a problem. We may have lost Fred, or he's locked up now.
Oh, I'm
see
still
him.
Here.
You're still there. Okay, good. Sorry, you cut out there for a second for us.
Sorry about that. This flaky internet thing. Somebody should fix it.
maybe Comcast will.
Yes, but as David Weinberger has famously written, it's broken quality that makes it worthwhile.
Yeah, it's a bug, it's a feature, not a bug.
Yes. So complete that thought.
Oh, so I was just, as I was just saying, the Sony defense is basically a shield for only one of three different kinds of secondary liability claims. So it's no longer the perfect defense that many people thought it was, and I think that it ought to be, at least in the eyes of the courts more recently. It won't protect you from inducement claims, and it may or may not protect you from vicarious liability claims, depending which court you're in front of.
All right. Well, Evan, I have a question for you somewhat related to this LimeWire case. Tell me what a document retention policy is, or a data retention policy.
It's an example of a very good idea for any enterprise, something that's a good idea for them to have. You know, we're inundated with electronic information and, I mean, not just electronic information, you know, documents, papers, but, you know, specifically information that's in electronically stored format. And you know, in a lawsuit, or if you're, you know, gearing up for a lawsuit or getting ready to either be sued or to go out and sue somebody, one of the things that you've got to be thinking about is how to have all your evidence, your evidence ducks in a row, so to speak. So a document retention policy is something that's critical to have in place so that you can feel well prepared in the event that there's a dispute. But there's also benefits to having it as well, just so that you can manage the information lifecycle that your enterprise goes through. So a document retention policy, or what the various names for it here, is an established protocol that the entity will have so that information, whether it's an electronically stored form or whatever, as it ages out to a certain degree, it can be effectively dispensed with and gotten rid of, not only because it may be irrelevant to the operations of the business, but also because you just don't want this stuff sitting around for the evidentiary value that it may have down the road. So it's one of those things that is a hallmark of good digital and information housekeeping for an enterprise.
Right. And it's certainly something that law firms advise clients to do all the time. And something that violates no legal principles whatsoever. You're not required to retain all your data except in very limited circumstances. And of course, there would be some issues if you're trying to hide data after litigation has ensued and destroy evidence, that kind of thing. But as part of the ongoing course of doing business, I'm sure your law firm has a document retention policy. Probably all your clients do, or if they're, you know, consulting with your law firm on that front, they do. Right. Because it's just a good practice.
It is.
A lot of doctor's offices do.
Exactly.
I'm just going to say a lot of doctor's offices do. Lots of times when I'm involved in litigation and I'm trying to get medical records from a plaintiff who's suing my client from, you know, 10, 15 years ago, a lot of doctors will only keep medical records for 7 years after they're finished treating the patient or something like that. And they do it because the volume of the paperwork can just be overwhelming. But even if it's in a digital format and therefore doesn't perhaps seem as hard to keep track of, it is hard to keep track of when you just have that much information. Document retention policies serve an important purpose, but you got to be careful about them. You know, you have to be careful that the client is doing it just for management purposes, not to get rid of damaging evidence in the case of litigation, which I suspect is the segue that Denise is about to get to.
Yes, because of course in these P2P cases, we saw it in Grokster, it's an issue here in this LimeWire decision. They are combing through the record and the documentation surrounding the conduct of the business very, very closely to try and find evidence that the business was attempting to design itself to make a profit off its users' infringement. Discovery in the cases is very important, and what you learn in discovery in the cases is very important. And the universe of that information is circumscribed by what's there and available for the company. But if the company has been pursuing a good housekeeping-oriented document retention plan all along before the litigation came about, you're only going to be able to access what they have properly held on to. So, Fred, this has been a long run-up to a footnote in this LimeWire decision that mentions you and brings you in not just as an interested party, but someone who actually gets some play in the decision. You want to tell us about this?
Well, there's only so much I can tell you about it because, again, the controversy is, for better or for worse, apparently about me. So there was a line in the LimeWire ruling in that there's a long evidentiary set of rulings at the beginning of the opinion. And as part of that, the attorneys for LimeWire had asserted that certain testimony was attorney-client privileged and should not have been included in the record here. And in fact, the court agreed and found that there were a number of statements that were privileged and properly excluded here. But ironically, in the course of doing that, the court said that, you know, I'll just read it just so we're all clear, that that Mark Gorton, who's the CEO, states that that I, Fred von Lohmann, gave LimeWire confidential legal advice regarding the need to establish a document retention program to purge incriminating information about LimeWire users' activities. You know, a lot of people caught that to purge incriminating information line in there. And it led, you know, some reporters, Greg Sandoval at CNET, did a story about it and sort of speculating, well, what did the court mean? You know, I can't really add much context here because, as I just read you, the court actually found that my discussions with LimeWire were, in fact, privileged. So I am bound not to say anything more about what those conversations may have been about or may not have been about. But I will note that, you know, we have written the court and asked that the words "to purge incriminating information" be removed from the order because in our view, that's not substantiated by the record that's involved. So, you know, it's a bit of a tempest in a teapot, frankly, in my view. I am quite confident that I did nothing wrong. We'll see what happens. The attorneys for the recording industry are, trying to make a bit more of this by writing their own letter to the judge. I'm looking forward to having this all taken care of, soon. As I said, I think it's really not nearly as important as the actual legal rulings in the opinion.
I do feel for you, Fred, though, because it is unfair that, there was no reason for the judge to include that line, purge incriminating information. It's like the sentence says, Fred advised the client on the need to establish a document retention program, period. That should have been where the period was.
I was wondering, Fred, I haven't read the declaration, but did Gorton go on and actually testify that that was his belief?
Well, of course, because that is exactly part of what the court says is privileged, I'm not at liberty to talk about that.
All right. One other thing I wanted to just toss out for fun regarding this LimeWire case is a press release that caught my eye by a company called Tyversa that provides P2P intelligence and security services to corporations. This is one of the outfits that helps identify the users on services like LimeWire who are engaged in infringement and helps the plaintiffs pursue their lawsuits against them. And what I thought was funny was they've gone to the trouble of issuing a press release about how the decline of LimeWire means continued growth for P2P file sharing networks, which is sort of counterintuitive and strikes me as something that might be trying to scare up a bit more business for Tyversa. But Evan, did you take a look at this? And what do you think? Do you think the departure of one P2P service means that others will spring up in its wake?
Press releases are one of my favorite genres of literature because they're obviously slanted in a certain direction to make a point that obviously lends credence to the position taken by the company that wants to sell you something. So it's a lot of in this particular press release here, there's a lot of talk about the sky is falling and that, the central provider of P2P services now has been destroyed. And so all the refugees are going to be going to other places. And now it's going to be even more like guerrilla warfare. Perhaps that on a very high level conceptual layer is true. But, this press release here greatly magnifies that. And, we'll see maybe some changes, I guess. I haven't spent a whole lot of time thinking about it. I wasn't spurred to think that the landscape of information security is going to change a lot just because LimeWire might be shutting down. The basic thing is it's a nice piece of literature to add to the collection of press releases that are geared in this way.
But LimeWire decision itself cites evidence that folks inside of LimeWire around, was it the year 2000 when Napster shut down, talked about what an opportunity this was for LimeWire to take over their business. So it is ironic that as LimeWire goes down, someone else comes up. It's, what LimeWire itself talked about 10 years ago is now coming true for others.
Yes.
Right. And I think it's worth pointing out for those viewers who aren't already aware of this, that LimeWire itself, the software, has been open source for a number of years. And so there are already a number of derivative free open source alternatives. FrostWire, I think, is one that's very popular. And so I think the press release at least may be right when it suggests that, whatever happens to LimeWire, the company, P2P file sharing is going to continue to be just as popular and just as widespread as it ever was before. I think people don't actually need to change what they're using. They can just keep using the software they already have. And my understanding, I don't know, but I'm not sure. I mean, if you look at any of the file sharing apps out there, there's plenty of alternatives available. And even if their companies that are behind them disappear, the software keeps on working. I got to admit, I haven't fired up my copy of Morpheus or Grokster or any of those circa 2005 pieces of code. But at least the technology, there's no reason in principle why it would stop working just because the company is not there anymore.
And this seems to be a pretty big overstatement of the problem. I mean, what I gather, the information security risk is that you're going to inadvertently put something in a folder that's available for the content to be shared with other users, right? That for some reason, just based on intuition on how I use my machine and, you know, how I store files and all of that stuff, pursuant to my personal document retention policy, maybe we'll say it that way, that risk itself, even if the user base becomes fragmented out there using different, you know, new applications or whatever, that seems to be overstated a bit to me in this.
There's always going to be a few users who don't know how to set their, you know, default settings. And, you know, I have sympathy for them, but I'm not sure there's any magic bullet to solve that problem for everybody.
Maybe they deserve their stuff to get stolen then, right?
Well, I'm not going to go that far because obviously that probably describes my father as well as anybody else. So I do have sympathy for them, but I do also think that the notion that it's you're going to design software for a personal computer that's going to live on the internet such that nobody can do anything to hurt themselves with it, that's a pretty tough criteria to meet. You know, after all, there's a lot of ways you can hurt yourself in an automobile, and people have been working for a lot more years trying to make those perfectly safe too. So, you know, there's always going to be people who overshare. I agree that when software does a bad job, you should call it out for that, right? I mean, certainly, I think you'd call out any other piece of software that you were using if the default settings were hard to navigate, c.e.g. Facebook.
Yes, which we will.
there's room to call it out, but I think let's not jump to the conclusion that somehow this is nefarious or people are trying to make people share their tax records. I don't see any evidence that that's the plan. Yeah.
So we'll see safer software like this when we see safer guns and safer tequila. That's a little bit of an inside joke. We were talking about that in the email exchange leading up to the up to today's show. But anyway,
yes, Seventh Circuit, and this applies to where why you might not want to hang on to every single one of your business related documents for time immemorial as well, or business related digital data. This was a case called Vince versus Rock County out of the Seventh Circuit recently. Had this wonderful line: a computer lets you make more mistakes faster than any invention in human history, with the possible exceptions of handguns and tequila. So,
right.
An astute observation by the court.
Definitely sounds like Judge Posner. I did a little bit of research on that quote, and it actually he was quoting from a Third Circuit opinion from a couple years ago, and that Third Circuit opinion in turn was quoting Mitch Ratliff, from an article way back in 1992. So we've known that that computers are inherently dangerous for quite some time, I guess.
Hey, just to close out this LimeWire discussion, it seems like the RapidShare case that we were talking about earlier is sort of the next iteration of how people can share information on the internet and how companies can have a business model that will actually survive the challenges posed in cases like Grokster and LimeWire. That there is a path forward, and that perhaps RapidShare and its ilk are charting that path. Fred, is that sort of an accurate summation?
Well, I think the only guarantee is that any path forward is going to be filled with legal costs. I think that's the only thing we can say for certain. Certainly, if you look at I started this fight back in 2001, essentially, saying, hey, the law of secondary liability is so confusing that entrepreneurs and investors don't know what's allowed and what's not allowed. And we lawyers have no coherent way to advise them because the law is so confusing and such a mess of contradiction. And we had hoped that with the Grokster case, the Supreme Court would try to clarify some of these rules. But if you look at the recent cases, compare the LimeWire ruling with the RapidShare ruling, compare both of those with the Perfect 10 versus Visa case, where Perfect 10 tried to sue Visa for providing payment services for infringing websites, and the Perfect 10 versus Amazon case, where Perfect 10 went after Google and Amazon for helping people find infringing stuff. look at those rulings. I challenge anyone, lawyer or non-lawyer, to try to extract any coherent advice that you could give a company that wanted to enter this field, hosting stuff in the cloud. It's really hard to understand what the rules are. I don't think the courts know. And so I think while companies will continue to try to find that path, just as you said, Denise, I think it's going to continue to be a path that's fraught with legal trouble.
All right. Well, also fraught with legal or privacy related in any way, at any rate, trouble, as we mentioned a minute ago, has been Facebook lately, not getting good press at all, getting a lot of attention to how difficult its privacy settings are to navigate, to the extent that its public policy head, Tim Serapani, has announced that there will be some changes and some more simplistic options available for tweaking your privacy settings on, say Facebook. So far we haven't seen those, but at least there's some hint that Facebook is listening to these concerns and is planning to address them. Fred, I noticed that Kurt Opsahl has posted over on your Deep Links blog and a bill of privacy rights for social network users that seems very commonsensical about the kinds of things that users should expect. Do you foresee that we might actually get some positive change here?
Well, I'm not the person who's been front line on the privacy issues with Facebook, but I can say we at EFF are looking forward to the promised changes, and we have some optimism that there will be some improvement. Whether it solves all the problems or not, well, it's premature to say, but I think it underscores that, you know, people care a lot about the privacy issues, and Facebook is, you know, was debuted, the whole underlying concept of Facebook was that here was a place on the internet where you could share without sharing everything with the whole world at the same time. And so trying to navigate the expectations of now an enormous number of people, it's going to be a challenge for them. And I think it's important that all the users keep, you know, holding their feet to the fire and saying, hey, this is what we thought the rule was, and now we've been surprised. And also help people control this stuff. So, you know, there was a great little technology item that many people may have seen, a little kind of plugin called Reclaim Privacy that you could use that would basically show you how much information your Facebook account was leaking and to who. And I used it and I was surprised that there were some things about my Facebook settings I didn't understand until that plugin showed them to me. So I think there's work to be done.
Yes, in fact, we're going to make that our resource of the week for Twill this week. Is available at reclaimprivacy.org. If you have not gone, and it's a little bookmarklet, you can add it to your browser, and up at the top, you'll have a little button that says Scan for Privacy. Once you're logged into Facebook and on your privacy settings page, you click the bookmarklet, and it runs a little test, and it tells you with varying levels, sort of reminiscent of Homeland Security color coding, whether you are safe or secure on a number of fronts. And Evan, you brought this to my attention. Did you run it on your account, and how'd you do?
I did. This is it's an excellent little tool. It's great. Like Fred, I wasn't doing as well as I thought I was. You know, it's pretty comprehensive. You know, knowing what, you know, identifying whether there's you know, your contact information is available, you know, what parts of your profile are available. So there were some things that that I ended up changing after I ran this so that I was more clamped down, so to speak, after doing this. So, yeah, it's very popular. You know, there are almost 49,000, almost 50,000 people who like it on Facebook. You know, we used to would have called them fans. So this is a great tool that it's well worth the couple of minutes to install the little bookmarklet and run it on your profile.
You know, the flip Absolutely. Side of this, are y'all familiar with the Open Book website? Jenny Jardin sort of referred to this a little bit on the last Twill, although she didn't actually name the site. I think because she was concerned about the privacy of the information on it. I personally think it's fair to identify the site. It's youropenbook.org, youropenbook.org. And this is a site that takes advantage of the Facebook APIs that allows you to do searches of status updates that people are posting but have not made private that are available for public. And one of the things that's amusing about the site is when you go to it, by default, it's got a search bar like Google. And by default, it plugs in some searches that would yield some interesting results. And I just jotted down a couple of them that will come up. Searches such as lost my virginity, divorce trial, cheated test, going to a strip club, playing hooky. And, you know, it's funny, you put in playing hooky and you see in live time all these people who within the past couple of minutes have admitted that they're playing hooky. Put in, I hate my boss, and you'll be amazed what people are saying online. It's, you know, and of course you wonder, do these people realize that what they're saying is open to the world? They should, because, you know, Facebook does, you know, a little bit to make sure that you have opened up your privacy settings to the world. There was that pop-up that happened a couple months ago that we all had to click through. But you got to wonder, when someone's talking about the fact that they, you know, cheated or did something wrong, do they realize that anyone in the world can see this? It's illuminating.
I'm not worried until it gets all semantic on us, because every time I'm going to the strip club, I don't say I'm going to the strip club. I say I'm cashing out this 20 for singles. So, so we're all good.
Absolutely. And you know what? I mean, as funny as that is, when I ran the test, I came up secure on everything but instant personalization, which I went ahead and left on for now. I didn't opt out of it when I had the opportunity to do so when I first turned it on. Because to my way of thinking, the things that I'm sharing on Facebook are you know, if they're going to share those things with third-party sites, it's actually okay with me, because I'm not... sharing that I'm cashing in my 20s for singles, you know? I mean, I think
you just have to assume that every single thing you put on Facebook is public. And you can't right. assume otherwise.
Right. So I think, you know, it, as with all social media, you have to utilize a little common sense, and then these privacy settings don't become quite so critical.
Yeah, but there's also a way in which we have learned from history that, you know, I'm reminded of the Usenet. You know, folks who were using Usenet in the early 90s who were shocked and amazed when they discovered that Google acquired the entire Usenet archive, and you could search and find everything they said when they were, you know, 17 years old and thought they were talking to a tiny universe of like-minded computer nerds. So it's the moving nature of our expectation that causes a lot of this confusion. And so it's true now, of course, it's easy to say you should imagine, you should, while you're on Facebook, you should behave as though every single thing you post there was public. But I think that comes as a real shock to people who may have started using Facebook back when it was, you know, just their college or just university students, or, you know, seemed very different. So this kind of shifting expectations, I think, is something, you know, it's hard to solve this problem.
We did our resource of the week then, reclaimprivacy.org. Before we get out of here, Jeff, you had a tip of the week for us, which since you are the iPhone JD, is, and I will go ahead and say that you have a post about 60 applications that folks might want to check out. But I asked you to pick out your favorite. Which one do you want to feature for the show?
You know, it's tough. There are so many good ones, but quickly, anyone, whether you're a lawyer or anyone that deals with documents, I think it's incredibly helpful to have an app like Documents to Go or Quick Office. These are the apps that allow you to edit Word and Excel and PowerPoint, but mostly Word documents on your iPhone. I find them useful, not necessarily because of the editing features, because you're not going to write the next novel on a device that's got a screen the size of a playing card. But I find that when you're reviewing Word documents, and I'm constantly receiving Word documents all the time, it's just so helpful. These apps do a nice job of displaying Word documents. You can pinch to make the text larger. And unlike the normal iPhone feature where you then have to scroll back and forth across your screen, it actually reformats the text so that it fills the screen. They're just great ways for looking at documents. And one other I'll mention real quick is a Log Me In Ignition, which is a great app that allows you to use an iPhone to connect to another computer, so that if you have, for example, software that runs on your work computer, that doesn't have an iPhone client, you can just connect to your work computer and look at your work computer on the iPhone screen. It's tiny, but it's usable. You can access it. You can type things in. And, you know, many times I'm on the road out of the office, but using LogMeIn, which costs $30, I can access my work computer and get some work done. It's really useful. But the place that I have a bunch of them listed, if you go to iPhoneJD/60apps, I've got a list of about 60 of them that we put together in March of this year when I was up in Chicago at the ABA Tech Show, which is the American Bar Association's big technology convention, where we had a packed room that we were talking about useful iPhone apps, and there's a whole bunch of good ones there.
Great. So lots of good business uses for the iPhone and iPad will present themselves if you go and check out Jeff's list. And with that, we're going to go ahead and sign off, Twill61. Thanks so much for joining us, Fred. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
And folks can, of course, find Fred at EFF.org and frequently posting to the Deep Links blog there. So thanks so much for your contributions and for your generosity in being on the show.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
And donate to EFF, everyone. Next, Evan, thanks so much again for joining us. We look forward to having you next week.
Looking forward to it too. Awesome time. You know, it was great talking with you, Fred. Nice to meet you, Jeff.
Likewise.
And I should mention about next week, we folks in the chat room have been asking if the Bilski decision has come down yet from the Supreme Court. This is going to be the software-related patent case. No, it has not yet come down, but we are watching that closely. And as soon as it does, we're going to have a show that goes into that in detail. So stay tuned for that if you're interested in Bilski. Next week, we are going to have Cory Doctorow and Mike Masnick on the show, in addition to Evan and me. So we're really looking forward to that one too. Jeff, great to have you on the show. And where can folks find you aside from iPhoneJD.com?
iPhoneJD, or my law firm's Adams and Reese in New Orleans here, arlaw.com. Thanks a lot for having me. I listen to podcasts all the time, and being on a podcast is sort of like, instead of, you know, watching The Office on TV, I'm sitting across the table from Steve Carell. It's a little bizarre, but thanks for having me here. It's a lot of fun.
I must say that is the first time I've ever been compared to Steve Carell, but I'm sure it won't be the last. Thanks a lot, everyone, and we will see you next week. Take care.